that baby up. Yeah! Crank it, girl, crank it. Doesn't that just sound like wind and sails and swords clanking? Arr! Ahoy, matey! Shiver me timbers! Yeah, I'm going to stop that now. All right, who doesn't love Captain Jack Sparrow? That's what I was getting to. Blackbeard, Redbeard, Calico Jack. Oh, yes, and Captain William Kidd. Ring a bell? No, no. I know Captain Jack Sparrow isn't actually a real pirate, but don't we all wish he were? The legends of swashbuckling pirates are fodder for young imaginations and great Halloween costumes. What up? The golden age of pirates was from about 1650 to 1730. They were sailing around the world, exploring new lands, and taking whatever they wanted, because they could. The oceans then were like any new territory, lawless, wild, and corrupt, like the Wild West. And the internet. Captain Kidd was a Scottish pirate who ended up being hanged in England and left there to hang for 2 years. One of his ships, which had been left to his crew for safekeeping when he tried to make a run for it, was then looted and burned by them in 1699. Sunk. But where? Where? Well, that darn ship eluded determined treasure hunters for over 300 years. 300 years people were looking for this thing. With purpose. It was discovered at last in 2007. Not even that long ago. I will ask our first guest to explain where it was finally found, because I just don't get it. John Foster was a professional archaeologist for 35 years with California State Parks. He has a specialization in underwater archaeology, which has allowed him to dive and research historical shipwrecks and other submerged sites all over California, Baja, and the Caribbean. Currently, he is an adjunct faculty member with Indiana University. That just screams underwater archaeology, doesn't it? Where he teaches in their Caribbean Studies program, haha, in the Dominican Republic, which brings us back to Captain Kidd. Thank you for joining us, John Foster.
Hi, Brooke. It's a pleasure to speak to you today.
Appreciate it. So tell us, what is up with Captain Kidd's ship? Where was it found?
Well, it was found in a isolated cove on a little island offshore from the country of the Dominican Republic. And it was the culmination of extensive research for many years and then a stroke of luck, which allowed us to actually find the spot. And it was so exciting. It was so exciting. There's a cannon pile of 26 cannons there, and it's just a remarkable sight in very shallow water.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. That's the kicker. This ship was found, what, in water 10 feet deep?
Yes.
And then it was, I think I read, 70 feet off the coast of one of the islands. So how, it's baffling to me that this could have gone undetected for so long, right, you know, clear in plain sight, or hidden in plain sight, I guess is the phrase.
Well, you've got it. I think that's exactly what happened. And we were, no doubt, not the first people to actually see these cannon, but we were the first ones to recognize their significance, report those to the government of the Dominican Republic, and now the site, after thorough research, has been made into an underwater park and preserve in the country. And so visitors can now come and see a real pirate shipwreck in shallow water. They can snorkel it. They can look at the cannons. They can hear the story, and they can actually feel the excitement.
That is really cool. That's really cool. So I had never even heard of underwater parks or underwater museums until reading up on you and what you do. Are they very popular? Do people do this a lot?
Oh, it is very popular. Yes, People love being around the ocean and snorkeling and scuba diving, and to be able to see original shipwrecks, artifacts, and history is something that's very attractive to people. So these sites are very valuable.
Yeah. Now, to back up to your story, how did you discover archaeology for your vocation?
Well, I had an interest in archaeology from an early time, and starting about in the sixth grade. But where most people grow through this and find something else to do, I just always had this in the back of my mind, and it And it developed into a real interest of mine. When I was in high school, I found a dinosaur bone. And that just triggered this intense excitement to find out more about the past and to learn from these discoveries and so on.
You found
and
a dinosaur bone?
It just developed from there.
Where did you find a dinosaur bone?
In a creek bed in Palos Verdes.
So you're...
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So you're just being 12 years old, doing your thing out in a creek, and you find a dinosaur bone?
Sticking out of the bank, yeah.
What?
And so I recognized it as some kind of a dinosaur, but they called in, my mom actually called the L.A. County Museum of Natural History, and they brought out a team, and they dug that bone out of the bank, and took it away to the museum. And
you were like,
really
I
excited.
Rock.
Yeah. I've made a real discovery. So that was really something.
Yeah, that
but
doesn't
anyway,
grab
I, you. I went on to develop a very strong interest and majored in college in anthropology, specializing in archaeology. And from there, I developed a specialty in underwater studies and underwater archaeology.
And how did that come about? Were you already a fan of diving? Were you already a diver?
Yes, I was already a real water person and a diver and everything. And then I had a chance to develop this specialty as part of my state job as the state archaeologist. They needed an underwater person. We didn't have anybody. I said, you know, I could do this. And so I went down and went through 2 weeks training at Scripps and became an advanced diver and developed my underwater archaeology techniques from there.
Now,
and it's proven to be a very, very fun way to apply archaeology for me.
I bet. Now, other than the obvious, being underwater, are there many differences in how you do your job between underwater and on land?
Well, it's basically archaeology underwater is the same as the archaeology on land, except that it's a little bit more difficult and it's a lot more expensive, but it's really the same techniques. You systematically and carefully study sites and try to identify them and understand their significance. And so it's the same as land archaeology, really.
So when you find something, and I know you don't only do shipwrecks, although that does seem to be the coolest to me. When you say let's take a ship, let's take Captain Kidd's ship because that's just fun. When you find Captain Kidd's ship, what's the process? What do you do? How do you approach it?
Well, we go down and we measure all the components of the site. We determine and map out everything that is there, and then we come back and make a drawing of that and look at each part of the ship. So we have to tell, for example, which is the bow and which is the stern? Where are the artifacts? Which way are they pointing? What's the evidence for how that ship came to grief at that particular spot? The time period involved, the circumstances of the loss, anything that relates to its history, all these things are put together in a composite which allows you to understand the site and its significance. Much of it can be done without excavation, but at some point in time, you usually have to do some excavation to recover things that are not visible on the bottom without it.
And what would those be? How would you find them if you can't see them?
Well, the key to identifying the Captain Kidd shipwreck, which is called the Cato Merchant, was the particular methods that the ship was fastened with. In other words, was put together in a specific pattern of carpentry, which was particular to the Indian Ocean and the maritime traditions there. We found those joints, we found that carpentry, and we were able to identify the ship from those clues.
And you feel conclusive, or is there always kind of just a little bit of doubt? Because how do you ever really, really know, or do you feel pretty certain?
Well, I think everything fits. Everything fits from the history to the artifacts to the dates of everything. But I think the clincher was the architectural details that we recovered in the ship itself, And those point conclusively to an origin in the Indian Ocean. And there are just no other ships that fit that description. It must be the Cato Merchant.
Gotcha. Okay, folks, don't go anywhere. We are talking to John Foster. He is an underwater archaeologist, and that's just super cool. He deals with pirate ships. He checks them out. He scopes them out, and he tells us all about them. We are going to take a very quick break. You are listening to Lancer Radio on lancerradio.org, streaming live from the beautiful campus of Pasadena City College. I am Brooke Peterson, and don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
There was a time when a pirate was free to make his own way in the world. But our time is coming to an end.
And that was from Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. I'm sure most of you have seen those fun movies. Today, we're talking with John Foster. You are listening to Sweet Life, by the way. I am Brooke Peterson. We are streaming live from the beautiful campus of Pasadena City College here in Pasadena, California, in the SoCal area of California. And John Foster was an archaeologist with California State Parks for 35 years, recently retired. He now is an adjunct faculty member with Indiana University, and they very frequently go down to the Dominican Republic and do some underwater archaeology down in there. I have to say, John, that, you know, Indiana, I think of Indiana, I don't think underwater. I don't think water. The irony just cracks me up.
Well, it does come as a surprise to some people, but Indiana University has a very large underwater science program, and they're one of the few schools in the country that you could actually go and study not only underwater science, but the underwater science applications in terms of underwater parks and management of offshore resources and those kinds of things. So it's actually a very popular selection for going into that as a career.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, how many other educational options do people have for this kind of work?
Well, it's a narrow field, and mm-hmm. and so it's a specialty that has probably more applicants than positions available. But, you know, as the oceans become more accessible through technology, and technology is constantly allowing a deeper examination of the ocean bottom, this kind of specialty will grow in popularity, and I look forward to the future where underwater archaeology can be done in the deepest oceans of the world.
And how far away do you think that is?
Oh, we're almost there. I mean, we're at the point now where using underwater robots and various other tools, we are beginning to explore this vast storehouse of human history that lies beneath the sea.
Very cool. And so are there, when you have this technology, are there famous or maybe not so famous, but maybe famous to you, shipwrecks that you just, your holy grail, are there things out there you're just dying to find?
Well, there are, but there are lots of ships that are going to prove to be typical of different nationalities, different time periods, different trading routes and that kind of thing. So it's going to help us flesh out the human history over the course of many, many, many thousands of years. And that's going to be the exciting thing. It's not the individual ship so much, but everything it can tell us about the history, ancient
cool.
and more recent.
Yeah, so that's a good point, though. So when you find these ships, and I guess, like you said, the more ships you have, the more bits of data you collect. What are the things you are looking for? You said trading routes, and why are those things important to us?
Well, they help us give us a deeper understanding of the important milestones in human history. Let me give you an example of a site that I was fortunate enough to dive a few years ago off the California coast here. It was a ship called the Montebello, and the Montebello was a 400-foot-long oil tanker that was steaming north on the California coast 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. It was off the coast of Santa Barbara County and ran into a clearing in the fog, and it ran right across in front of a Japanese submarine.
Mm.
The Japanese submarine fired a torpedo, blew the bow off the Montebello, and it sank in 11 minutes.
Wow.
This huge oil tanker went down, 11 minutes. Well, the crew scrambled into three lifeboats, and they made their way to safety. But the deck gun of the Japanese submarine opened up and sprayed bullets at them.
Wow.
Well, they got to shore after a harrowing experience and told their story. And it convinced the U.S. government that there was a Japanese invasion fleet sitting off the coast of California. And the President Roosevelt responded to this perceived threat by establishing the concentration camps, which impounded the Japanese citizens of the Pacific coast. In any event, this is all due to the incident where the Montebello was attacked and sunk off the coast. And I had a chance to dive that site a few years ago. And it was an extraordinary experience because we were in a little two-man submarine. The site lies at 800 feet of water. So we took this submarine to the bottom of the ocean and then scooted along till we found this massive structure of a 400-foot-long oil tanker sitting upright on the bottom. Just amazing.
Wow. So when you come up on something like this,
are important because they relate to our history. Some of it, as I said, is recent, and much of it is ancient. But those kinds of things are milestones in human history.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it must be. So this was not like a site you guys discovered. You knew where it was, right? But you're going there to visit and do your work for it?
We went to the site because it was thought that it was still contained its tanks full of the oil cargo, and that those, if the site breaks down, if the shipwreck breaks down and releases that oil, it could be a big problem on the California coast. So that's what it made
it worth
looking at. We were looking at that and any sign of it, and also the history, but. Yeah, it had a practical. The expedition had a practical aspect in that it was searching for any possible oil leaks.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes perfect sense after so many years and
right.
what it went down with. So, but my question is this: okay, so say you're doing your job. You're either in a sub or you're in your dive gear, and you're making your way to the site. What goes through your mind, or maybe even your body, when you first see the goalpost, you know, what happens?
Well, you know, I got to say that in spite of all of the academic training and everything else, I just respond to that thrill and excitement of discovery. And this is something I think that really draws people to archaeology. It's finding something that isn't known, being the first one to see something. You know, as archaeologists, we don't own these artifacts. I mean, these are the artifacts, the treasure is really the history, and the history belongs to everyone. It doesn't belong to us because we saw it first. But nonetheless, the excitement of the discovery, being the first one in dozens or hundreds or maybe even thousands of years to cast your eyes on some piece of history, is something that really does draw me to the field and many other people too. And the general public loves this. And that's why these TV documentaries and so on and radio shows are so popular.
Yeah. So as a kid, were you an adventurer? Would you consider yourself an adventurer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was out looking around, finding things, and very, very driven to that kind of thing in my early youth. So, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Do you find that to be a common trait among most underwater archaeologists?
Oh yes, I think that's right. And now there are many other opportunities to add scientific specialties, mapping, study of climate change, all kinds of other things that have a bearing on the archaeologist's world. So it's becoming a, I'm an advocate for archaeology, anthropology being a good major, because I do think that it allows you to develop skills that are very marketable.
Very cool. And what would you consider to be one of the most challenging parts of your job, or something that might be a little bit less fun, less glamorous, that you weren't aware of when you got into all this that you might would have liked to have known?
Well, everybody imagines diving in warm, clear Caribbean water. But lots of times our archaeology is done where the ship's wrecked, which is generally a pretty nasty place to dive. Mm. So sometimes we dive under conditions that aren't ideal as far as diving goes, but that's where the history is, and so that's where we go.
Is it dangerous? Have you had any close calls?
Well, once in a while you have a few things happen that, sometimes, but nothing serious. I've dove in very fun but very challenging places, the Sacramento River and Lake Tahoe and a sinkhole in the Dominican Republic, absolutely dark down there. Just imagine trying to find something. You only have 11 minutes. You're at great depth. You're in an alien world, and all you can see is what your flashlight in front of you illuminates.
Oh, my gosh, that's terrifying.
So it makes doing archaeology a real challenge.
It sounds like a horror movie. What are you talking about?
No. It's a lot of fun.
Okay.
But you have to keep your wits about you.
All right, if you say so. Although I'm sure I definitely get the Caribbean waters part, though.
Yeah,
that sounds
exactly.
Good.
Right.
Now, what discovery have you found that has excited you the most? What's been your prize sight so far?
Well, I've been fortunate enough to be part of many expeditions all around the world, really, from different sites, different shipwrecks and all. The one I'm excited about currently is a 1725 Spanish merchant ship that we have discovered in the Dominican Republic. We're working with the Dominican authorities on its excavation, and it's proven to be really, really fun because we have a trial record of the loss of this ship because the captain was prosecuted for silver smuggling. And so because of that, we have all these details that we usually do not have when we find a shipwreck. And in this case, the case of the Begonia, lost in 1725, we have all of these court records. We know the name of the crew, the name of the passengers. We know where it originated, who the owner was. We know what they found. We know what they recovered there at the time. And it's really an exciting ship to explore.
Very cool. Very cool. Now, is there anything that what's your oldest discovery? What's the most historic? I guess the dinosaur bone when you were 12, right?
Well, yes. Another site in the Dominican Republic we've been working on is a site that relates to the Aboriginal people there. The Taino was the culture that greeted Columbus when he arrived in the New World. And in a remote limestone sinkhole in the East National Park in the southeastern part of the country, the Dominican Republic, I was part of a team that first explored this site. It required a 50-foot rappel down a hole in the ground to an underground lake and then a dive of 122 feet to get to the top of the archaeological deposit.
Wow,
but
that sounds
there,
awesome.
In complete blackness, because there's no dissolved oxygen in that water, everything that ever went down that hole is perfectly preserved. So,
oh my goodness,
we found gourds and baskets and wooden objects and pottery and everything.
Oh, so talk about a holy grail!
It was a glimpse of a culture that you usually don't have as an archaeologist because very, very often the organics don't survive.
But yeah, that must have just been
all there.
Thrilling.
So that was
for you.
Really exciting.
Yeah, well, Mr. Foster, we're talking to John Foster. That's our time. He is an adjunct faculty member with Indiana University and was the only underwater archaeologist with the state of California for 35 years. Thank you so very much. This has been such a pleasure.
The pleasure's mine, Brooke. Thanks for talking to me.
All right, then. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.